This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith.
It's been long time coming. It's going to be a long time gone.
Dear extraterrestrial visitor, things are past serious here on planet Earth. Our top scientists, the people who study and measure, warn the web of life is headed towards utter catastrophe, possibly in just 90 years. The ocean, source of our oxygen and mother of most of our life, is turning acid due to our carbon pollution. Our once stable climate, the basis of our agriculture and civilization, is undergoing violent change. As I record this, smoke from forest fires hundreds of miles away in the mountains is filling our great city. I can smell it, the distress, and it's only June, not even fire season yet. Last night, as we watched TV news, a reporter showed the tinder-dry conditions on Vancouver Island. "My God," said my companion, "that is the rainforest, untouched by fire for 1,000 years or more, could burn." It's only a matter of short time. The great pine forests of the Rocky Mountains have been killed by global warming. They stand dead valley after valley, each long trough visible from space, discolored, waiting to burn. Each great tree is a tower of carbon taken from the atmosphere. Now it will go back in great bursts of fire that nothing can stop. A burp of carbon worse than the Indonesian rainforest fires of 1997 and 98. Greenpeace predicted this in 1994 in a report called The Carbon Bomb. Now it's happening. Here in the Rockies, all from California right up to the Yukon, even the boreal forest, the clothing of the North, it's burning out more carbon than new trees can gather. Vast forests will convert into grasslands or scrub deserts. We don't know how far all this new carbon, coming in the next decade, will push the climate. The carbon whirlwind is still of our own making. Will you be a witness, or will you be the change we need? This is Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. What is this program about? Is it the horrible fear about the future? Not really. We're going to delve into vision and conversion, yours and mine. How do we change from passive viewers to become the actors for the Earth? As government fails, as society cracks wide open, how can we be what the Earth needs? What if you're already typecast and maybe even successful and well-known in your role? Could you drop all that to start up again? Just because an inner voice calls it and says it's the right thing to do? This is the story of three lives changing. They call on you, not to follow them, no, to realize your own mission to do what you were born to do. Zipporah Berman is an iconic forest activist. Okay, she's one of the green media stars of the woods. While executive director of the eco group Forest Ethics, Berman has a breakdown realization. The biggest forests are already dying and burning, not from loggers, although there are plenty of them, but from coal plants and car exhausts. Climate change is now the biggest killer of the woods. We'll hear a hot new speech about her conversion to climate activism. Maureen Jack LaCroix produced movies and organized big music festivals. One day, Maureen says, she got a spiritual call to devote 10 years to Gaia, the life force of Earth. She started Be the Change circles, small groups of self-motivators. That became an organization, Be the Change Earth Alliance. On May 23, 2009, I took my recording equipment to their latest so-called unconference. Yes, there were two short speeches, and we'll hear them. But people grouped at intimate tables, around tables. Everyone got a chance to speak and to share. This was not a place for learning from authorities, but from each other. There was no passive audience. It was you. Get involved.
Turn
I came away thinking, this is it. This is how it can happen across North America and around the world. And that's why I'm doing this radio program, to invite you, yes, you, to convene a little group of people pointed towards a living world. Go on. Be the change. Then we'll wrap up with the most difficult conversion of all. Christianity still dominates the mental majority of the worst carbon polluters in the United States and Europe. Some people blame the Judeo-Christian-Muslim separation of God from the living earth for our rapacious culture. Fundamentalist Christian teachers continue to deny the sciences of evolution, geology, and now climate. Can Christianity become compatible with science? The science that warns us of a new sin that could burn our living world. In a short speech, Pastor Bruce Sanguin proposes a new reformation, a vision of green Christianity. Is it possible? Will anyone listen? We'll also squeeze in a few words from Aaron Stevens, CEO and co-founder of the cereal and whole foods company Nature's Path. He was one of over 20 table leaders at the Be the Change event. I also have a sample of unconference conversation for you. Two women in the hallway, sort of walk-by audio. Great Gaia. All that in 1 hour? We better be going. Zipporah Berman knows big change. She could have been a middle-class success story at anything. Instead, she popped up on Canadian TV screens and then around the world as the passionate and photogenic spokeswoman for the anti-logging protests at Clackwood Sound, a gorgeous old-growth inlet on Canada's far west coast. There hasn't been any environmental protest quite like Clackwood before or since 1993. Canadians are generally a quiet, law-abiding lot. Yet over 850 people were arrested. They got their criminal records at this protest, perhaps more than at any other green protest anywhere in the world. Businessmen in suits bust up to get themselves a criminal record. Grandmothers and even children were dragged away to police vans and then to jail. 12,000 people joined the protest in the remote woods. The big band Midnight Oil came out for a free concert held in the infamous black hole of burned out stumps. Clackwood Sound was designated a World Biosphere Reserve by the United Nations in the year 2000. Zipporah Berman worked for some years for Greenpeace, helping to organize negotiations between the big logging companies and several environmental groups, including Greenpeace, the Sierra Club, and Rainforest Action Network. Meanwhile, Greenpeace offices around the world organized not just media-catching protests, but one of the first and largest corporate boycotts in history. Paper companies and lumber companies began calling the BC corporations like Macmillan Bloedel to cancel their orders. I have to tell you, even the producers of German porn magazines called up to say, nah, we can't take old-growth paper. The consumer pressure was just too hot. Finally, years later, in another big step for environmental action, the largest companies joined the government and private foundations and the Aboriginal people in signing a protective agreement for the Great Bear Rainforest. Huge virgin rainforest valleys were saved for the future, while other logging had to meet sustainable standards that included wildlife protection. During the battle, Berman joined another organization set up by those three groups called Forest Ethics. Note that despite her later claims, Zipporah did not found Forest Ethics, but joined as an employee under then-executive director Michael Marks. But this green dynamo, Zipporah Berman, certainly took Forest Ethics to new heights, becoming the executive director and its guiding light. She continued her forest activism with a single-minded heart that few could match. But then something happened. Zep, as she is known to her many friends, ran into a wall of fire. It was climate change. She'll tell us in her own words, after a lively introduction by Maureen Jacques Lacroix of the Be the Change Earth Alliance.
corporate CEOs in their big offices and convinces them that maybe they shouldn't put out those big catalogs, and they don't. And she's had a tremendous influence on the movement overall. She's going through an interesting transition herself right now, because Forest Ethics was, she's a co-founder of, it's like having a child, having an organization like that. And now her child is growing up and she's letting it do its thing. She's only there 25% of the time. And she's starting a new organization called Power Up. And it's a citizen engagement program that is focusing on climate change. Because as she learned more and more about the urgency of what's happening with climate change, her perspective got broader and broader from the forest to the whole global situation. And she's a beautiful woman. She really integrates so much. When I was talking about all those dimensions, she holds all those dimensions in a beautiful way. She's been accused of howling at the moon as an eco-goddess, and she has been accused of being a rabid eco-activist, and she is innovating all the time how to approach getting people to wrap their heads around this new way of seeing things. So I'm honored and privileged to invite my dear friend, Zipporah Berman, to speak with you all now.
Thank you, Maureen, and thanks to the Be the Change Earth Alliance for organizing this incredible event and for all the work that you're doing and for inviting me here today. Just the process of coming here and speaking turned out that I had to figure out how to let go and be the change, just like this conference is doing, because I sat down and thought, okay, I want to communicate the urgency of climate change and why I'm doing what I'm doing, and I wrote this speech, and then I found this email from Maureen about 2 o'clock this morning that said, oh, and by the way, don't bring any notes, and I was like, okay, I'm not doing the speech, and so then I put a bunch of images together, and I thought, well, I'll show you what's happening on climate change around the world, and then I got here, and I was like, no, you can't, there's no images, and so letting go is a process of being the change. So Maureen, can you let me know when I'm halfway? Can I look over there and you let me know? So what I'm going to do is tell you some stories and a little bit about what I've been doing over the past year and how I let go of the work that I've been doing for the past 15 years and why. And what I'm doing now. And I hope that it can give us a bit of a level playing field for our conversations today around the urgency of the climate change issue and what we're facing, but hopefully also inspire you a little bit around the art of the possible and really taking this moment to be responsible not only for what we do, but for what we don't do, and to be responsible for recognizing that we really do have to be the change and we can't expect other people to do it. And I think actually that's what I was doing for several years. And, you know, you can't not hear about climate change, right? It's everywhere. It's front of Time magazine. It's in every newspaper. It's everywhere you go. And for a really long time, I'd been seeing those reports cross my desk as I was working on forest issues here in Canada and other places and thinking, wow, that's getting worse and worse. That is really bad. And I'm so glad someone else is working on it. And so for those of you who don't know me, I spent the last 15 years working on protecting forests and changing the trade of wood and paper products. And that journey has taken me from working with the Friends of Clackwood Sound and Western Canada Wilderness Committee on Vancouver Island and blockading logging roads. I was arrested in 1993 and charged with 900 criminal offenses. and then when that didn't work... When the blockades and the protests and when the logging just continued, I worked with Greenpeace and then other groups and eventually founded Forest Ethics to go to who was buying the products and convince them that they had to use their influence to help affect forest protection and change in the way that paper and is made in North America and what kind of wood is bought. So that journey took me to boycotts in the United States and Europe and eventually to other countries. And the end result of that work, to make a very long story short, for me was that I found myself in a place about a year and a half ago where Forest Ethics had contributed to the protection of about 66 million acres of old-growth forests so far in Canada and the U.S. and Chile. And we had transformed the practices of some of the largest corporations in the world. I mean, when we started campaigning against Victoria's Secret, they were making a million catalogs a day. They were a million catalogs a day. They were primarily about 90% was coming from Canadian old-growth forests in the boreal, and they were using less than 2% recycled fiber. So, you know, and we campaigned against them. We launched a campaign, Victoria's Dirty Secret. You may have seen our posters or ads with a woman in lingerie holding a chainsaw saying Victoria's got a dirty secret. That caught their attention. And the result of that was we and 850 protests in front of Victoria's Secret stores in 18 months was that we ended up working with the senior management to green their practices. They became the first large catalog company in North America to have a dramatically changed procurement policy. And so here's the first story. There was a moment for me when I realized we had reached a new level of this work, when I asked Victoria's Secret as part of the agreement to work with us to change the way governments look at forest protection and forest practices. So they came with me to meet with a government here in Canada, and the government, the Ministry of Natural Resources guy was sitting there saying with the Premier's office, well, you know, blah, 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 caribou like clear cuts and we're doing fine, and you know, that thing. And that they always say, and the guy from Victoria's Secret just leaned back and he said, I don't think you understand. I buy $100 million worth of paper every year. And I want to buy from Canada, but I can't unless you're providing recycled fiber and more Forest Stewardship Council fiber, unless you're protecting more forests and you're not logging an endangered species habitat. Like, I can't buy paper from you because it comes with protesters attached. So until she's happy, we're not happy. And it was this moment of, like, I realized, first of all, that I said nothing in the meeting. Didn't need to. And the guy from the Premier's office was just going. He couldn't speak. And it was this moment of realizing that we had we'd harnessed a whole new power through this collaboration and with industry. And it was very exciting. And so then getting back to where I am now. So that's all happening. And a report comes out saying recycled mills in North America are working at an all-time high. And it's because of the increased demand of Staples, Office Depot, and Victoria's Secret, which was Forest Ethics' first three campaigns. So we've started to change the way that paper's made in North America. It's huge. Then I was invited to speak at Bali at the International Climate Negotiations on... I'm clearly not using any of those notes. On the impact of logging on global warming. And Bali changed my life. You know, I knew a lot about climate change. I think we all do. And I had just started seeing the maps showing that the forests that I'd spent my whole life trying to protect were now under threat, probably more due to climate change than industrial logging. And I was trying to ignore that. I don't know how to deal with that. I work on logging. And then there I was in Bali, and I was sitting feet from the Secretary General of the United Nations. And he came out, and he said, unless we reach a strong agreement here to reduce emissions, fossil fuel emissions, we are dooming humanity to oblivion. And you could have heard a pin drop. I mean, there's 30,000 people from over 100 countries. And I turned to the woman next to me. Did he just say dooming humanity to oblivion? Because I thought, and I just realized that, I mean, I've been called, you know, by Glenn Clark, Premier of the province, an enemy of the state on national television, an eco-lunatic. Okay? You know, I've never said anything that crazy. And this was the Secretary General of the United Nations. And so then I thought, hold on. And, you know, I have to really listen. And I have to really let this sink in. So I went to every panel on the International Panel on Climate Change there in Bali that I could go to. And we all know, I think, in this room that global warming is happening, that it's human caused, that it's a direct result of carbon emissions that have been increased by 70% since 1970. You know, those are things that I think a lot of us know now, and we know that there's a scientific consensus. And what I didn't really realize is that we're experiencing the warmest planet that we have in 420,000 years, that the warmest 10 years on record are in the last 15, that the scientists are now saying a 2-degree warming is unavoidable. Unavoidable. So what does that actually mean to us in our everyday lives? Well, a 2-degree warming is unavoidable. Well, the difference between now and the last ice age was 2, 3, at most 4 degrees. So then I started going to the predictions of, okay, so if we just stabilize emissions at where they currently are, which we're not, what's going to happen? And I went to the Africa panel where they said that by 2020, that's not very long, you know, 11 years, Africa, many countries in Africa will produce 50% less food. That by 2020, there'll be 2 billion people in the world that don't have enough water. By 2050, there will be 150 million environmental refugees. To put that in perspective, we have 23 million environmental refugees on the planet today. And not environmental refugees, but just refugees totally. And people are dying every day. 150 million? And I started grappling with the fact that these issues aren't issues anymore for those of us who have a soft spot for big trees and bears. This is the moral challenge of our age. It's the challenge of our age. And how do we grapple with something that big? So imagine my horror when the next day the Canadian government arrived and spent the entire international negotiations playing way above its weight and stalling an international agreement. I mean, I've traveled a lot internationally, and you meet people, and they love Canadians. Oh, you're not American. Hi. You know, oh, ginger ale. You know, they love us. And there I was in Bali at the international negotiations, and you'd meet people, and they'd say, oh, you're Canadian. I'm sorry. And it was like, whoa, you know. And so I came home determined to figure out what is going on. Like, how is it that Canada has some of the weakest laws and policies in the world to address global warming? How is it that our emissions are rising faster than any other G8 country? And I found what I'm sure many of you know, and folks here from the Dogwood Alliance and other environmental organizations that are working on tar sands and oil, of course, know this very well, that Canada's home to the single largest fossil fuel development on Earth. And that while we're all driving to work and changing our light bulbs and changing our lifestyles, Canada's emissions are going up because of heavy industry. And in fact, 40% of our projected emissions in the next 10 years are projected to come from the tar sands. And it all of a sudden hit me that, yeah, we need to change our light bulbs, but we need to change our laws. And how do we create that conversation in Canada? So I spent a good 6 weeks on the floor of my living room playing Lego with my boys in my pajamas. And when they were asleep watching Battlestar Galactica and eating potato chips, that was my strategy for dealing with this new crisis, because I realized it made me question everything I do, my entire work in the world, and how we function and how we spend our time. And it was actually listening to Barbara Kingsolver on the radio one day that got me out of my funk. And she said, someone said, how do you remain hopeful? And she said, well, I'm a mom. Hope is the only moral choice. And it just hit me that, you know, I have to do everything I can. So I started researching and exploring the issue. I went and met with someone I knew in the Prime Minister's office, and I said, okay, help me understand this. I've seen the polls. Canadians care about global warming. We have some of the worst laws and policies in the world. I mean, China has stronger vehicle efficiency laws than Canada. The UK has committed to all carbon neutral homes. Right now, Obama is spending 6 times as much per capita as Harper is, to create green jobs, to create renewable energy, to turn the U.S. towards a low-carbon economy. Why aren't we doing these things in Canada? I don't understand. And she said, these are difficult changes. And yes, Canadians care. They don't really understand it. They're not really organized. So we're doing enough. So then I went to a conference where the Prime Minister of Denmark was speaking, and oh my God, it was so inspiring. Denmark is doing incredible things, reducing their emissions, increasing quality of life, increasing community engagement. You know, people are involved in the transition. They're excited about the transition, and they have more jobs and a stronger economy today than when they started. And I said, how are you doing this, to him during one of the breaks? And he said, what do you mean? And I said, well, we just had an election where someone who was supportive of the carbon tax lost, and we don't see our government's not doing anything, and you know, how did you have the social license to do what you did? And he said, civil society demanded it. I had no choice as prime minister. And so I decided that my work in the world was going to be to do this, to engage Canadians across the country from the right and the left around not only the urgency of this moment, but the promise that we have to understand the issue, to talk about the issue, to connect with each other, and collectively call for stronger laws to limit and reduce pollution right away. Because this is not rocket science, and I think the issues have really been obscured. I mean, I have 2 degrees, and I spent 6 months going, okay, I'm for 80% by 2050, but that's at 1990 baselines, and oh no, it's a carbon tax, no, it's a cap and trade. What are we for? What we need to do is limit pollution. We have to stop treating the atmosphere like an ashtray. We need hard caps on pollution across the board, and that includes the tar sands. And I think, in fact, that our government is going to be forced to do that as a result of what the Obama administration is doing. But we need to engage on that. We have to get off oil. We have to stop using fossil fuels. We have to increase conservation and efficiency as much as we can and support government leaders who are doing that. And we have to dramatically increase our sources of renewable power and move the economy to a low-carbon economy. So those are our kind of priorities. That's what we need to do. And how do we as individuals do that? We need to commit to talking about these issues, to, yes, changing our lifestyles, but it's not about buying the right product or not buying the right product. It's about engaging in civil society. It's about writing to your MLA or your MP. It's about joining any of the number of incredible organizations that are here today and who aren't here today but who work on these issues. The David Suzuki Foundation, the Pembina Institute, Sierra Club, or Power Up Canada. Any of these organizations who are trying to funnel and organize public concern into action on these issues. Because we have 3,000 days. And we cannot forget that. I met with the chief scientist of NASA, James Hansen, and he said, we have about 8 years before we reach a tipping point where there's literally so much carbon in the atmosphere that we could ban all the cars from the planet and global warming would continue to be out of control. It would continue to escalate and make an increasingly inhospitable planet. Violent storms have already increased by 50% just in the last 20 years. We have about 3,000 days to move to a low-carbon economy. And that means we have to be willing to change what we do in our daily lives and how we engage and teach our children. We have this strange society where we have an overdeveloped consumption muscle and an underdeveloped civic engagement muscle. We've forgotten how to volunteer. We spend our time at the malls. This is the time when we need to engage and when we need to volunteer. When we need to take risks, and we need to understand that there is no silver bullet, there's no one answer. This is messy, and change this fast is going to be messy, and we're not always going to agree. Those of you, many of you probably have seen the press around the BC election, the press around run-of-river issues, private versus public power. These are important debates to have, and we need to have them with heart. We need to engage in them. We don't have to agree all the time, but we need to respect each other and the fact that we're working from a place of purpose and intention and try and find the solutions together. Because anyone who tells you they know what the answer is in the climate era is not being truthful. We don't have all the answers, but we need to try and shift this beast in the right direction. And I'll leave you with one story. My grandmother, who was in her 90s, died this summer, and I got to spend 2 incredible weeks at her side. And I was having a crisis of faith. creating a new organization after having one that already had 34 staff in three countries, and it just felt like maybe I'm insane, and Power Up Canada was struggling to figure out what it was going to do, and the issue just seemed so incredibly big. And she said to me, you know, when your mother was growing up, we didn't have a phone in the house. No one did. No one took airplanes, by the way. Like, that just didn't exist in anyone's lifestyle. The way that we communicate with each other, the way that we travel, the way that we fuel our homes, everything was different. We didn't have computers. We didn't have cell phones, let alone that Raspberry you're always carrying. She said, my BlackBerry. She said, I have watched the world entirely change in my lifetime. And we are at a moment, you have the opportunity to contribute to the next change, because there's no question that we are living a tipping point. The world can entirely change in our lifetimes. We actually have most of the technology and science that we need today to change the world, to live in a low-carbon society. She didn't say that. I inserted that. That was my part. But what she said is, the world has entirely changed. And I'm sitting here telling you about what the world was like when your mother was a child. Tell me, what will you tell your children? And I said, Grandma, I'm going to tell my boys about a crazy time when we logged the last of the old-growth forest to make catalogs, when we fueled our cars with gas. Because when I'm telling my grandchildren that, we won't be doing that anymore, because we'll live in a different world. And I leave you with that image and invite you to share that image with me and to work every day in our lives and in our homes and in gatherings like this to continue that conversation and, in fact, to dedicate ourselves to that conversation. Because if we are the change and if we're committed to it, then we can make this change happen. Thank you.
That was famous forest activist Zipporah Berman, recorded by Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock from Be the Change, May 23, 2009. Now Zipporah is executive director of a new organization aimed at weaning Canadians from fossil fuels. It's called Power Up Canada at powerupcanada.ca.
I need a peace to be held up, a peace to be held up. Appears to be
an awful time. It's a long, 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 long time before the dawn.
Back in 1968, when David Crosby wrote that song, it seemed a long time coming. It was. Now, over 40 years later, it seems to me the time has come. The great turning, for better and for worse, has come. Let's get back to being the change. Here is my quickie interview in a doorway with Aaron Stephens, CEO and co-founder of the big natural cereal and whole foods company, Nature's Path. He was humbly leading a circle table, one of the 270 people giving up their whole sunny Saturday to thrash out grassroots activism. This is Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock, and I'm sitting here at the Be the Change conference with Aaron Stephens, and he's with Nature's Path. And I want to ask you, sir, what do you see yourself as the role of a corporation being the change in this instance?
We have to become the change we want to see in the world, as Gandhiji said. I sought business as a means of right livelihood, and I could only do that if I could change the environment of the working place. So the business, our business stands on the three legs of sustainability, social responsibility, and also viability financially. So the business that we have, which is Nature's Path, is dedicated to leaving the world better than we found it.
And how long have you been involved in this, or how long have you been working on this direction?
Since 1967.
That's quite a long time. What would you advise other people who are in business to become part of this change? Do you have some advice for them?
I think you need to have a very clear picture in your mind first. And once you get that clear visualization of where you want to go, and if you're prepared to make personal sacrifices, if you're prepared to adhere to your goal without flinching and bear the shocks of falling down, and you have to pick yourself up, then you can manifest your dream.
And you're leading a table discussion. There are roundtable discussions happening. What are some of the things that you're talking about, or that you're hearing others talk about at your table?
We're talking about many things that can affect positive change in the world. And one of the things that we are discussing specifically is how diet can affect climate change and also personal transformation.
That's interesting, because we just did an interview on Globesity, a book about how people around the world are becoming overweight due to diet, and also the role that diet plays in global warming, and that if people eat too much, you have all that extra agricultural production and the emissions from that, and the transportation, and also people moving into meat diets, which add again to global warming. Could you say a little bit about that?
Yes. A vegetarian diet that is eating very low on the food chain can solve a lot of the global warming problems and take millions and millions of cars off of the highways by reducing our dependency on growing, say, soy, cutting down rainforests, growing soy and other grains to fatten cattle, which are then end up at McDonald's and Burger King and things like that. So, for example, what do you think has more beneficial environmental impact? Not eating steak, a 2-pound steak, or not taking a shower for 5 months?
Well, I'd have to go with the shower, but I'm
yeah.
Wrong.
Actually, it takes 3,500 gallons to shower during that period, but it takes 5,000 gallons of water to grow a pound of meat.
And that's in a time when water is being stressed as the glaciers melt and so on. Now, another thing I want to ask you about is that while Monsanto, for example, is limiting our choices and making all one grain, perhaps, or something like that, I've noticed that your company has been seeking out some of the older grains and bringing them back and putting them into cereal. Would you tell us about that?
Yes. We need the biodiversity. We need the rich heritage of a multitude of grains. Companies like Monsanto basically have limited the world's production. They've now over 90% of the world's soybeans and corn are genetically modified. So at the Green Conference, at Fortune's Green Conference last year in Pasadena, Hugh Grant, who is the CEO of Monsanto, got up to speak of the wonders of genetically modified foods and how it's going to end world hunger. So then they invited questions from the audience. I was expecting Greenpeace to say something, but they didn't. So I got the last question in, which was, are you aware of the landmark study done by the University of Kansas that has proven that genetically modified foods actually have a yield 10% lower than conventionally produced soybeans and corn? And I said, what do you have to say about it? And he changed the subject.
Understandably. Is there anything else that you'd like to tell our listeners about?
Just that each one of us has within us the power to change the world for the better.
That was Aaron Stevens, CEO of Nature's Path. We're at the Be the Change Unconference in Vancouver, May 23rd. Each circle has a leader, but everyone has two chances to speak, holding the talking stick. It was a mass participation event. I tried to record a table with Vancouver's deputy mayor and longtime Western Wilderness activist, Andrea Reimer, but the background of so many people exchanging, well, it overwhelmed my equipment. I wanted to grab it all. I heard so many intriguing conversations. We'll have to settle for this audio walk-by in a hallway between two women participants, one fairly fresh from Romania. Let's listen in.
Not so much that, I mean, Romania also has a lot of waste. Like, they'll use plastic bottles. There's nowhere to recycle. So, yes, they haven't really gotten that far with it. But they still know that they have to eat, like, a certain healthy meal and diets. But all this American, all these American products that are coming in, McDonald's is sprouting out. They can't afford to buy McDonald's. I mean, it's cheap food. It's not sustainable for them. It's not healthy.
Cheaper than real food.
Yep. It's destroying people staying in their homes and eating with their families and keeping that connection going, conversation, you know, being able to relate to your family that way.
You know, I'm visiting Mexico in the winters for a few years, and over the years I've seen real change there too, because I think a lot of North Americans go there because they like, you know, if you're in your 60s, you remember the 50s, mm-hmm. You go back there and it's like, Oh, yeah, there's a shoe repair guy down the street. He remade my shoes for $5. We couldn't even communicate. You know, but it's like going back to the 50s. And it's, so it's familiar and it's really cool, but that's changing. And they're getting all the fast food and they're drinking Coca-Cola by the gallons. And they're getting obesity. They're getting all of the same problems that we go there to escape. We go down, there to see a simpler life where people sit in the town plaza and play with their grandchildren, but that's changing really fast there because, again, of the North American influence down there. So it's interesting.
Looking at the root of the problem, which was the influence of North America coming in and being like, here are products, you can't afford them, but we're going to sell it to you anyways.
Coca-Cola.
I mean, lots of Latin American countries cannot afford to live on their own. They're now, like, being sent to monocropping farms. They don't have their own land anymore. Like, they don't have time for their families because they, you know, they need to provide food. So they're going to have to pay on, like, less than $2 a day to not even be able to afford just, like, healthy meals. Like, a bag of beans would probably cost, I don't know how many days of work, or month, I don't even know, but it's just, it's not sustainable, and it seems that a lot of these multinational corporations do not care. They don't. And it's like, and it's them that need to change as well. They need, especially them, because they are influencing so many people. Now it's a codependent sort of situation between these farmers who are not working for themselves. They're working for the big company and they're being sucked dry. There's nothing in it for them. Nothing.
And they're going to the factories to work and they're going growing coffee instead of real food and
And monocropping too. It's just like if you have like pineapple fields, you're not going, that land is not going to be as arable and good to grow anything else later on. It's sort of destroyed. And a lot more of the environment is destroyed when you've just plant one certain seed. That's why there's always been this variation, and a lot of traditional farming, they know when to farm what or what fruits and vegetables work well together to make a healthy soil. And that's forgotten. That's sort of ignored. And that's important.
And there's so many issues, and one I've really noticed too is, and again, my generation are traveling everywhere. It's almost like, you know, travel competitions, trophy travel. I've been here, I've been there, I've been everywhere.
Yeah.
And there's even church groups, apparently, I've run into this, where they send a small group of people to Africa to help for a couple of weeks to do what? I don't know.
Yeah.
And, you know, not thinking that the flight that these people are taking is doing more harm to those people than going there and imposing our culture on a village in Africa who doesn't need it anyways and needs to find their own solutions to their problems. And, you know, it's our whole lifestyle and how it's affecting the rest of the world. It really is. Yeah.
Tracking the Climate Challenge, Radio EcoShock at ecoshock.org. Our time to consider conversion is running out. We'll go to the granddaddy of green problems. Can Christians accept a new climate science? What kind of stories bring all of us together to make the changes we need to survive? Our host, Maureen Jack LaCroix, conference organizer for Be the Change Earth Alliance, introduces Pastor Bruce. Don't run away. Bruce Sanguin has a vision that just might make this work.
And again, this is a talk that is really encompassing all of the talks, and it's a thematic one for the Great Turning. Bruce Sanguin is the minister at Canadian Memorial United Church, and he has been speaking behind a pulpit, with the pulpit, for over 20 years. He's renowned within the tribe of United Church ministers as being the little out there kind of minister. He's very eco-spiritual in his approach. He loves the earth. He feels very, very connected and being of the earth. And he's written a couple of books that are now really starting to take off around the world that are shifting that old paradigm of church within the Christian tradition. It's called Darwin, Divinity, and the Dance of the Cosmos. Bruce really recognizes the evolution, the whole universal 14 billion year legacy that has led us to here, and sees the evolution of consciousness as part of the divine unfolding. And I welcome him to speak with us today. Bruce Sanguin.
I don't have much time, 15 minutes. It seems impossible to do what I want to do in 15 minutes, but if we could take 30 seconds of that 15 minutes just to be in silence together, if you'd join me, and we'll just kind of take a moment to breathe. Maybe allow gratitude for the miracle of this moment to arise within us. Perhaps to allow wonder at what might just emerge as a result of this gathering, this conversation. A moment to be in and with the mystery of existence. Thank you. One of the technologies, sort of group process technologies that I really appreciate is called World Cafe. And basically it's about getting a whole bunch of people like you in conversation like we're doing today. And what seems to happen, they don't talk about it in these terms, but as you do that, the system connects more deeply with the wisdom within the group. And something new emerges from those connections that's unpredictable. And it's actually how the universe itself evolves. When parts come together, what emerges is not just a whole that's greater than the sum of the parts, it's completely novel. And so what you're doing here at your table groups by connecting more deeply with each other is creating the space for the possibility of the emergence of something completely new and novel. It's part of the mystery of being together and the miracle of being together here today, which I never really get over. So it's my bias and experience that what has called us together here and what is at work here is what some call a hidden wholeness at the heart of the universe, or a pattern that connects. The religious traditions might call it God or spirit, but some mysterious power, force, love that has drawn us here today. It's amazing. So I want to just share with you my own experience of how I arrived at a spirituality that for me supports this purpose, creating an environmentally sustainable, spiritually fulfilling, and socially just human presence on the planet. About 20 years ago, I was away at a silent retreat, just 10-day silent retreat, just being silent. And I read a book by the mathematical physicist Brian Swim. Many of you are aware of Brian's work. And it's called The Universe is a Green Dragon. When I closed the book, I realized that I had undergone a transformation of consciousness, the implications of which I would be dealing with for the rest of my life. And I articulated that to myself. I put the little book down. I said, I got enough here to work with for the rest of my life. And I had undergone a shift in a fundamental understanding of who I was. And I remember walking along. It was in Narragansett, Rhode Island, and I spent 4 days doing nothing but walking on the shoreline with the awareness that I was the universe, being aware of the universe. And that was my mantra. I am the eyes of the universe. I am the ears of the universe. I am the consciousness of the universe. And when I looked around at the world out there, I realized that, of course, everything is. You are what the universe is doing. And as I walked upon the earth for the first time in my life, I got it that the earth wasn't outside of me. Well, in a sense it is, but it wasn't so much that I was walking upon the earth. I was walking as the planet in human form. I don't know where I thought I came from, right? But I hadn't got it for 40 years, 35 years. I didn't get it that I was an emergent form of the planet Earth. And it's so obvious. It's the most obvious thing in the world that we are what the universe is doing in this moment. We are the consciousness of the planet in this moment. So what gets in the way of the realization of that unit of consciousness? And I think that's what we're all struggling with now. As a species, we're just emerging out of this modernist period where we spent a lot of time differentiating ourselves, distinguishing ourselves, perhaps necessarily so, from the creatures and from the planet, so that we could discover our distinct identity and our true potential, and that is a gift of the modern era, and there's no point in trashing that. But what has happened is that distinction and differentiation turned into disconnection, disconnection turned into dissociation, and from that dissociated state, we have enacted so much terror upon this earth and upon her creatures that now we're asking ourselves, how do we find our way home to the cosmos? How do we get past this dualistic worldview that says, I'm over here looking out at the universe out there, or I'm over here looking out at the earth over here? Because from that dissociated state, someone else has said it here this morning, we look out at the planet, and in this modernist period of the industrial era, we have seen the earth and her creatures as resources, primarily for our consumption. That's what can happen. That's a kind of a psychotic, it's a dissociated view of the world. And as one indigenous tribal chief said, what you people call natural resources, we call our kin. So this is the shift in consciousness that I'm about. I'm just saying, like, how can we help people to overcome that false sense of not just separation, but disconnection and dissociation from the cosmos, to shift our identity to realize that we are the presence of the universe. We are the presence of the earth. And more than this, this is what I got with my experience in Rhode Island. When I was walking along the seashore repeating this mantra, I must have looked like a crazy man, but I just wanted to get it. I never wanted to lose it again, right? I wanted this to be who I was. So when someone asked me, who are you? I'd say, well, really, I'm the universe, noticing the universe, and so are you. It takes a while to get there, but that's who we are. And I knew, because what I was seeing through these eyes was I looked out at creation, and everywhere I looked, I saw creation radiating with a sacred interiority. And the materialistic bias of the modern era was completely broken down. And the dualistic theology that I had been taught in seminary was gone forever, with this God out there, creation over here, and every once in a while God would intervene to save humanity because we were so bad. Right? When I say that I'm a Christian, that's what most people think Christians are. That's my experience anyway. So no wonder when you announce that you work in a church, you're a Christian, half the room usually empties. So I really appreciate you folks hanging around for this. And I want you to know that there's another way of being, having Christian identity. And it's an ancient identity that the mystics of the 12th to the 14th century just knew. They knew they were the universe radiating sacred energy. They got this piece. We had to unlearn it. It took hundreds of years of theology and seminary to unlearn it. So here's my thing. If we really did get this piece, this unit of consciousness, that we really are one with the universe, one with the planet, and that all of creation radiates with an interior sacred dimension, that we are bio-spiritually kin with all creation, if we really got that, how could we do what we're doing? If that was our identity, how could we enact this terror? How could we overpopulate the planet to the point that we're just stealing natural habitat from all the from our kin? How could we pollute every biosystem on the planet? I don't think we could do it if we got this piece. And I think that's what we're running from. Because when you get this piece, if this is fundamental to our identity, it changes how we want to be and how we want to live upon the planet. It really does. So this is, you know, in that's Joanna Macy's scheme of things, the eco-activist. I'm just humbled by by all the eco-activists out there and the eco-innovators. And my piece in this, my primary piece, seems to be around the eco-consciousness shifting. I want people to do what they're doing out of this sensibility. And what I got in that, what called it whatever you want, that awakening for me, was that this whole narrative, like, a people can't live without a sacred narrative. Our indigenous people had their cosmologies, their sacred myths. Christians and Jews and Hindus and Buddhists to some extent, they all have their sacred stories. We're trying to live without a sacred story in this modern era, and we're not doing so well with it. We need a sacred myth that tells us who we are, where we came from, where we're going, and how to live on the earth. But we need a story. And what's so exciting about what science has given us is that, in effect, science has given us a new sacred story, a text. It's the evolutionary story of the universe, the great story. The problem is, when we learned this in school, if we've been taught about evolution at all in school, here's a fact, I bet you didn't know, we're still not teaching evolution in our schools. I knew they weren't doing this in the U.S., but I discovered only Quebec is actually teaching the theory of evolution. We're teaching about dinosaurs, but we're not putting it together. We're not telling it as sacred as poetry. We're telling it as sort of science, as prosaic, factual, here's what happened in a materialistic way. But what if you begin with the great flaring forth 14 billion years ago with hydrogen and helium coming together, forming star fields? And out of those star fields, those galaxies, some of these stars go supernova. All of the elements necessary for life on Earth, the heavy elements come into being. Our solar system is formed. Our planet develops this relationship with the sun, and life emerges, bacteria form, eventually nucleated bacteria, the five kingdoms of life. And what if you just lose the materialistic bias of science? Not all science, but lose the materialistic bias and say, this is an evolution from simplicity towards complexity, towards beauty, towards consciousness. And after 14 billion years, here we are sitting here today, wondering how we can make this happen. I don't need another miracle. I don't need to know that anybody walked on water or believe in that literally. This is enough, friends, isn't it? It's taken 14 billion years for us to arrive at this moment. And we are the conscious awareness of the universe. And in us, this is what's staggering. And I think there's this interior dimension. I mean, in the great religions, they talk about God or spirit, but let's just leave it as a sacred interiority, that there is this hidden wholeness, this pattern that connects, that is biased in a non-coercive way as the persuasive presence of love drawing us towards increased complexity, increased beauty, increased consciousness. That's the great story. It's scientifically based, but it can be told as sacred myth. And in effect, I think this becomes our scripture for the 21st century. Creation itself becomes a sacred text for the 21st century. And it's a text that will transcend our great religions, but it will include them. So I don't have to worry about the particular Judeo-Christian myth of creation being lost. It'd be transcended and included. I'm done. Thank you, friends.
That was Pastor Bruce Sanguin, a United minister in Vancouver at the Be the Change event, May 23, 2009. Find out more at bethechangeearthalliance.org. bethechangeearthalliance.org. You'll find helpful links in the Radio EcoShock blog entry for June 4th as well. Just go to ecoshock.org and click blog. I've added a listing of all our radio shows on the drying west, the dying trees, and the risks of a climate conflagration. Those are MP3 files for your download, free and commercial free. Climate and forests are tied together in a divine dance. Find out more, won't you? I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for tuning in to Radio EcoShock, and let's talk again next week.
To be made love for, appears to be a such a long, long, long